Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Just one guest today, Jane McAlevey, talking about how to organize workers. A break from interviews about Greece. We'll be back with those next week. I do want to say a few words about the latest Greek developments, though. First, the hard line taken by the Germans and their lesser allies like the Dutch, the Finns, the Poles, and the Baltics is extraordinarily cruel and ugly. The Dutch finance minister reportedly told the Greek delegation to sign in the dotted line or we will collapse your banks. That's not negotiation, that's extortion, something out of Tony Soprano's playbook. The richer members of the hardline faction seem to be motivated by a desire to make an example of the country, lest the Spanish, Italians, or Irish get any ideas about rebelling against debt peonage. Ruling parties in those debtor countries have also supported taking a hard line against Greece, lest they lose upcoming elections to more radical alternatives. The Eastern Europeans seem motivated by a mix of envy and ass-kissing. Greeks have somewhat more generous pensions than they do, so they're happy to see them cut in Greece, which explains popular attitudes, and Eastern European elites want desperately to ingratiate themselves with their Western counterparts. It was really rich the other week to see big-time bureaucrat Donald Tusk, the former Prime Minister of Poland, taking a hard line with Greece. Apparently he forgot that his country got a near 50% debt write-off in the early 1990s, engineered by the U.S. as a reward for renouncing communism. Discussing the deal in an interview with the New York Times, David Mulford, the Treasury official under George H.W. Bush who led the negotiating team, cited the example of the debt forgiveness extended to Germany in 1953 as a precedent for the Polish deal. Yes, Germany, which had debts equal to about 200% of GDP at the end of World War II, more than Greece does today, but it had them largely wiped out. Of course, historical parallels are never exact, but the Germans and the Poles might want to think about treating others as generously as they were treated. And that's not to mention how badly the Nazis looted Greece in the 1940s, something that's largely forgotten. And another point, a lot of left critics of the Syriza government have been arguing that Greece should have just left the Eurozone instead of negotiating with its creditors. That may become necessary, but people should understand just what a desperation move that would be. As Yanis Varoufakis, the former finance minister of Greece, said on this show many times, if the government were to announce that it was dropping the euro and bringing back the drachma, money would fly out of the country. Elites would continue to live largely in euros, and the masses would be stuck with a depreciating drachma. It would take a year or more to reprogram banking and other payment systems for a new currency. It's not something you can do quickly. And during that period, capitalists would strip Greece of what assets it has remaining and park them abroad. The country would find it very hard to finance essential imports like oil, food, basic machinery, and medicine. Almost 40% of Greece's imports come from other Eurozone countries, and it would need euros to pay for them. How it would get those, complicated perhaps by sanctions imposed from abroad, is a mystery. Political will alone cannot fill the ATMs. The euro was a flawed project from the start, bringing poorer countries like Greece and the other debtors into the same economic zone as Germany, one of the most productive economies in the world, was never going to work without concerted, massive transfers from the richer regions to the poorer. But while there were some such investment funds, the hardline neoliberals who run the eurozone have a very stunted sense of generosity. The whole structure is a mess, and none of these agreements with Greece, whatever happens to them, has solved these fundamental issues. Okay, now on to Jane McAlevey. Jane, a frequent guest on this show, has an article in Politics and Society, a scholarly journal that's behind an expensive paywall, called The Crisis of New Labor and Alinsky's Legacy, Revisiting the Role of Organic Grassroots Leaders in Building Powerful Organizations and Movements. It's an examination of two very different approaches to organizing workers, one which she ties to the legacy of organizing guru Saul Alinsky, about whom, curiously, Hillary Clinton wrote her senior thesis in college and whose community organizing Barack Obama practiced in his brief career as a community organizer, which is superficial and top-down, and a bottom-up, whole worker style of organizing. If you have access to Politics and Society through a library, please check out this very important article. During the interview, we talk about a fellow named Jerry Brown. He is not the governor of California, but the now-retired longtime head of 1199 New England, a powerful and militant union local that has yet to be snuffed out by its parent, the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. Jane McAlevey. So, Jane, we're about to celebrate the 20th anniversary of New Labor. What is it? What's it about?
Yeah, the 20th anniversary. So it's a poignant moment, I think, to do some assessment and evaluation of really what's been happening in the last 20 years. But essentially, in the fall of 1995, the first contested election in the history of the AFL-CIO, and the AFL-CIO, of course, is our nation's largest labor confederation, and there had never been a contested election in the history of the institution. It was always sort of someone was the head of it, and then they appointed the next guy, and then they would run, and they were always just, you know, brought into power that way. So Coming off of the 1994 takeover of Congress by Newt Gingrich and company, so it's sort of the origins of the key part of the rebellion that led to the 1995 contested election of the AFL-CIO. Essentially, by 1994, you know, Clinton's in 1992, nothing's happening. Labor, as they always do, just like under Clinton, so back in 1992, they thought, oh, Clinton's in. We're going to have a change in labor law. We're going to have all these progressive things that will help unions. We're going to have, right, all the stuff that they talked to us and promised us during the campaign. And then nothing was happening. And then by 1994, you have what's been happening right now, right, in these sort of recent midterm elections. You had the sweep by the what we thought then was sort of the hard right wing. Now we have the Tea Party. But anyway, back in 1994, Newt Gingrich comes in. Yeah, the good old days of Newt Gingrich. So back in 1994, when the sort of serious right wing, you know, people begin to take over Congress, and the final argument that the old guard, sort of hardline old guard of the national labor movement, the Delane Kirkland era, the old guard lost their final argument about why they were the better guys to run the institution than anyone else, because they would always say that they could work well to get people elected. They did elections real well, and that didn't work out real well in 1994, right? So the possibility of, like, could we get labor law reform done, you know, under the Clinton just evaporated in front of the entire labor movement in 1994 because Congress gets taken over by Gingrich. You know, Gingrich becomes the leader. So essentially, that's sort of the final straw. It's not at all the beginning of it, but it's the final straw that begins to fracture the coalition of the old guard and the AFL-CIO among America's unions. And a new coalition begins to emerge. And they're using the defeat of the Democratic Party in 1994 as the reason why we need change at the AFL-CIO. That's sort of the most unifying, if you can imagine it, that's sort of the most unifying message that they could use to sort of build a new coalition to take on the old guard at the AFL-CIO. So there's a lot of maneuvers that happen, but essentially, fall of 1995 happens. The convention, the quadrennial convention for the election of the leadership of the American Federation of Labor, Congress and Guest Organizations, is in New York City. It's super high drama. I was not in the convention. I was around the convention at that time, as were many people. There were, you know, Teamsters for a Democratic Union. There were a ton of progressive, hard-hitting folks who had been campaigning for, you know, a couple of decades for the change that happened. And it really was the defeat of the Democrats in 1994 that was sort of the final blow to the old guard. So, you know, a new team is elected. There's a slate called the New Voices Slate, which has President John Sweeney in the presidential slot, right? Trumka, Linda Chavez Thompson. It's a return to sort of like a promise of a return to more sort of militant politics. It's going to be a tough AFL-CIO. We're not going to just roll for the Democratic Party anymore. And fundamentally, the message from the new leadership called New Voices, which sort of morphed into being the idea of sort of new labor. And by new labor, we mean the service unions, right? The industrial era is sort of a thing of the past. Big factories no longer dominate America. That was sort of the old days. So sort of the New Voices slate, the new labor slate, was more about the domination in the new economy by the service sector and service workers, healthcare workers, janitors, hotel workers, et cetera, with the recognition that the factories, you know, were no longer dominant in terms of the U.S. economy. So that's what new labor meant, and the New Voices slate was a particular slate of candidates that were put forward to run in 1995. So in they come in 1995. It's incredibly exciting time. Lots of folks decide to sign on and get, you know, involved in sort of what's going to be the new labor movement in America, and the single biggest campaign plank of the New Voices slate was that they were going to once again organize the unorganized in America. So the sort of platform was about organizing the unorganized and rebuilding the density of the American labor movement so that we could once again become powerful as a class force, though the word class was not actually on their lips.
So what was their organizing strategy?
So, you know, I mean, I think in the very early days of the changes at the AFL-CIO, this is a complicated story, right, which is sort of why I wrote 30 pages about it in Politics and Society, and I've got another 300 coming in a forthcoming book. So, and the entire, you know, my entire next book sort of just analyzes this 20-year period. That's really what I'm looking at. And I'm trying to figure out sort of what went wrong as someone who was both very deeply involved in the movement during this period, then also with a sort of, you know, a sort of critical eye about the things that didn't work. So when they started out, the idea was that you needed a 20% set aside, that 20% of all the money it was almost a neoliberalism in the messaging. It was like a marketing strategy, like a market theory, that if we put 20% of all of the dues money that trade unions took in from the rank and file members, if 20% of all the budgets were set aside for something called new organizing, that means organizing, unorganized workers who are not yet in a union, that that was going to sort of do it. We just had to sort of say we're going to do it. We had to just sort of prioritize doing it. And if we just put 20% of the budget of the union into doing organizing of unorganized workers, it was going to work. Now, there had already been something called the Organizing Institute, which Richard Bensinger, who's still around with UAW, most recently in that Chattanooga election. But Richard Bensinger was the head, was made the first organizing director, good organizer, smart guy. He had been running something called the Organizing Institute, which was sort of a prelude that was set up in the early 1990s, and then sort of that became like the model of the new organizing department, that the AFL-CIO had never had an organizing department ever. So these are big changes, very big changes. There's never been...
Most organizing is the responsibility of individual unions, not the federation itself, right?
Yes.
This is going to be a departure from that?
This was definitely a huge departure. It was the first time that an organizing department was set up at the National Federation, right, at the headquarters of the AFL-CIO. Yeah. I mean, in general, we have a weak federation, right? So for people who don't know this, the AFL-CIO is constitutionally a weak federation, and that becomes one of many parts of the problems that happens in the execution of this plan. They didn't have any authority to ask the individual national unions to sort of take up, go out and use our model and go organize. In fact, Bensinger only lasts for a couple of years in the position of organizing director, very brief tenure in that position, because he sort of went out assuming that he could just say to the national unions, look, you guys don't know how to organize. We actually do. We're going to teach you how to do it. And you set aside 20% of your funds, and you need to do it. And on those points, he was basically right. It's just that there was no mandate for the national AFL-CIO to be telling the national union sort of what to do.
But why wouldn't they want to organize?
Now we're getting into the weeds of it. So, I mean, there's several things. First of all, the world in 1995 and 1996, when the leadership change really happened functionally, the world didn't look quite as bad as it does now to organized labor, though, if you think about that in reverse, it really did. And in fact, if you read a lot of the literature, a lot of the books that were, the best books that were coming out about the labor movement, I think, in the late 1980s, there's a series of them. One by Howard Kimmeldorf called Reds or Rackets, really terrific book, sort of talking about how the longshore workers developed as corrupt and horrible on the East Coast and fabulous and progressive and smart and strike happy on the West Coast, right? So he does a dissection and gets to some of the same issues I'm going to get to in my next book, but he really dissects, you know, there's two different choices or three different choices, you know, that a union can take. So, you know, basically, the employers began to fight really hard in about 1973. So up until 1973, organizing didn't seem that hard. The employers grew, your contract spread, you grew with your employers. There was this happy social partnership between national unions and a lot of the employers. There was some fighting going on, but there was a period that was characterized as sort of labor peace, which it never was labor peace, just to be super clear, ever. But at some major employers like the auto workers and some other places, you know, supermarket chains back in the old days in the 60s and 70s, coming off the real strength of labor's real power in the 20s, mostly 30s and 40s and part of the 50s, you know, if the employer grew, sort of the union grew. That sort of worked until about 73, when capital decided that they were going to start really fighting back really hard, right? So we get through the 70s, and there's still some tremendous organizing going on in this country. There's a lot of strikes happening still. We hit the 80s, of course. Famously, PATCO happens under Ronald Reagan, and what is PATCO? It's essentially, you know, a defining strike where he says workers who go on strike can be permanently replaced, which essentially becomes the big challenge to labor. After that, a lot of unions just said, forget it. Well, we have no power anymore. Reagan said they can permanently replace striking workers. So where this era is unfolding, where things are just getting worse, and it's not obvious to people. It's not like a sledgehammer hitting them yet, though it ought to have been, and for some it was. But the mainstream folks just kept thinking, hey, we're getting our deals, we're getting our raises, we're growing a little bit here and there. They hadn't had a culture of organizing for many decades. So when the moment came to say it's time to organize again, because density, which means the percentage of workers and unions in this country, has really taken a hit between the 70s and the 90s, they sort of weren't even if they wanted to organize and organize, they weren't really ready for it yet. They didn't have any of the sort of skills and abilities in-house to really do it. Although what's ironic about that, as I say, and I'm happy to talk more about, is the truth is every union is sitting on the best organizing leverage and the best organizing weapon that we have, which is the existing rank and file of every trade union.
At this time, then, the AFL-CIO was offering technical help, maybe even some resources, and why didn't the union say, golly gee, we need this, otherwise we're going to go under?
Well, I think two things. One is that we need to separate out who we're really talking about in this conversation, and I do that in the beginning of both the next book, and I do that in this article, which is I say there's a set of unions who were trying to, who actually got committed to the idea that we have to organize the unorganized. And there's really only ever been about 10 of them. The other 50 or so in the national AFL-CIO basically have never gotten on this program for a whole variety of reasons. But I think the most simple one is that if you do serious organizing, you unleash the possibility that you will lose the office that you hold as a union leader because you're bringing new people into the union. They may have new and different ideas. You have to contemplate your own electoral strategy for your re-election to national office. And, you know, this is not a new idea of mine, of course. I just want to state the obvious. But a lot of these folks wind up in very good jobs. If they come out of the rank and file, the idea that you go from being a line worker at an auto plant to being a guy who makes, you know, $250,000 and wears suits every day and goes to the lunch with the employers in a bargaining context becomes a real challenge to how do you, what are the mechanisms by which union democracy really works? And there's a lot of good ink about this. But at a very fundamental level, I think the simplest argument for why unions fear doing organizing work of the unorganized in a serious way is because they're most concerned about keeping the power that they hold inside of their union. Any new organizing threat, any new group of workers that's brought in, is potentially a threat to someone's existing incumbency. And why someone would want to go back inside of their workplace, you know, when you think about the workplaces they came from versus the job they have sitting in an office, in a union office, it actually is a really complicated issue in the labor movement. So, but let's just say most of the unions were never on board with this. They never went along with it. They made the change at the AFL-CIO. It was a tightly stitched together coalition. There was a lot of maneuvering about how the change happened at the AFL-CIO. And again, I think had not the 1994 electoral disaster happened with Newt Gingrich, it may not have even happened. There may not have been the change at the AFL-CIO a year later, had not Congress gone to the control of Newt Gingrich, right? Like that really was a sort of, a final straw in a series of defeats that left the old guard vulnerable. So most of the unions thought they were signing on to having a better relationship with a stronger Democratic Party, and that we could just finally win some labor law reform because we were going to elect. And this is really what's been happening for several decades. Labor leaders believe if we elect Democrats, contrary to all evidence forever, that if we elect the Democrats, they will enact labor law reform, and labor law reform will facilitate the kind of organizing that doesn't require you have to set up a whole department, and you don't have to think a whole lot about it, and you don't have to get your hands messy and go out and can have contentious fights with employers. And by the way, people are still having that fantasy today in 2015. There's a whole trajectory of people in the labor movement who still believe all we have to do is get the right Democrats elected and we're going to have labor law reform. Now, just to go back in very recent history before we come back to what happened to the organizing model, this is really crucial because as long as trade union leaders and many of the staff in the trade unions believe that electing a Democrat in going into Obama's race in 2007, I was still very deeply involved. In fact, I was on the International Executive Board, right, of SEIU at the time. So privy to every conversation we were having about national electoral strategy, et cetera, were we going to endorse who, why, whatever. And at the time, the dialogue went like this. All we need is a Democrat plus 60. That was the lingo, almost as if you could wear a sticker that said, the White House plus 60, the White House plus 60. All we have to do, this is labor's rap, at the AFL-CIO and at SEIU, in 2006 and 2007, all we have to do is take the White House plus 60, meaning 60 veto-proof, you know, votes in the U.S. Senate. And we would then win the labor law reform that labor had been promised since Taft-Hartley in 1947. And we didn't get under Jimmy Carter, and we didn't get under anyone, and we didn't get under Barack Obama, because it takes way more power to move an agenda to have sort of radical labor law reform than it does to even try and win a local organizing campaign in a local facility.
Well, I remember that defeating labor law reform under Carter is one of the things that energized the new right. That's one of the things that really got
people
them into high gear.
Super excited, yeah, just like they're excited by Scott Walker now, because if you looked at his campaign launch yesterday, the most important message out of Scott Walker is I took on the unions and I won.
Yes, just yeah, like so Reagan took on PATCO and defeated the Soviet Union.
Yeah, exactly, right. But, I mean, you can see the theme running through this. But, yes, under Carter there was an attempt. And then under Clinton in the early years there was a huge debate about do we try and pass something that facilitates organizing or is the most important priority banning permanent replacements in a strike. There was a huge debate between the more leftist factions in the labor movement when Clinton came in, which bill should be prioritized. The truth is, it didn't matter, because neither one of those bills was going to go past a Democrat who was ushering in neoliberalism, as Bill Clinton did. it sort of just goes to like several of the things I talk about in the article. One is the concept of a power analysis and understanding how to do a power analysis and understanding what we can win based on how much power we have and then how much power we need to actually win the kind of things that we fantasize that we can win. So this whole idea that we were going to elect Obama or Hillary, because back in 06 it was just take the presidency plus 60. It didn't even matter if it was, it didn't matter who it was, Edwards or Clinton or Obama. It was just one of those three.
Any Dem.
Any Dem and 60 Dems in the Senate, and we were going to have radical labor law reform. They were going to bring in the Employee Free Choice Act, which was like EFCA, right? It was literally called EFCA, and I think we've talked about this before. But, you know, first of all, it sounds like a social disease. All they talked about was like EFCA, we need EFCA. All we could do is get the White House plus 60. So most of the unions had resisted setting up organizing departments and doing the very hard work of really doing bottom-up organizing, because one, it's frickin' hard, two, it threatens the established leadership of the unions, and three, because they're living in a fantasy about how power works in our country, which says we're going to elect the Democrats plus 60. I don't know what they say anymore. We're going to elect the Democrats plus 70? Like, where else do you go? Or do they finally realize that actually we're not going to have an election strategy that's going to change the fact that we're in total crisis? And part of what I'm saying in this article is you can slit your throat waiting around for labor law reform, or you can decide that we have to do something very different in the organizing model and how we engage workers in this country and how we think about the class, and begin to do the hard work of rebuilding a bottom-up movement. We no longer have enough sort of political or social capital in this country to get almost anything done, except in a few states we can get a dollar raise for fast food workers. We can't actually get any power. We can't shift the power. We can't win labor law reform. So it's sort of what I'm trying to articulate in this new article is there isn't any choice but to go back to a very bottom-up organizing model. And there are places that we can look at, and there are methods that we can use to do that. And the longer we put off doing the kind of organizing that really puts workers at the center of their own liberation, the further we get from the possibility of ever taking this country back before we blow it up to blitherines with climate change.
Okay, on that cheerful note. I'm speaking with the author, activist, organizer, and newly minted doctor, Jane McAlevey. So what kind of organizing model actually emerged or evolved out of this new labor moment that we've seen? Now we've got 20 years experience of it. What does it look like?
Yeah, so I mean, here's the evolution. So I think that there were some there was some good early effort on the part of the sort of the newly established organizing department, which, you know, first shoe drops, Benzinger is basically fired. I mean, he's forced to resign very early on. So you sort of realize, all right, well, we've got one problem already, which is the guy that was being, you know, brought in, ushered in to sort of create the new organizing model was quickly offed, right, because he pissed off too many national union trade union leaders trying to tell them, compel them to do something that we didn't have the power to do from the National Federation. So
shocked about their mediocrity, right?
Yes, but it's also like, again, very top-down model. You'll see a theme here, right? It's like we win the Federation, we appoint Richard Benzinger, we tell everyone how to do it, we're going to go from the top-down model of how to do a bottom-up movement. There's something in Congress from the opening of the thought, right, that we're going to, like, just from Washington say, here's how you do it, and it's going to happen. Anyway.
We're listening to the organizer and writer, Jane McAlevey. Her book, Raising Expectations by Raising Hell, was published by Verso. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Thank you. That was some of the first movement of Bartok's first piano sonata, performed by Martha Argerich. And now on to part two of my interview with Jane McAlevey.
The key that I want to argue is we very quickly get into a debate by the late 1990s called organizing versus servicing. In fact, it happened almost on the heels of the election in the fall of 1995. A debate emerges that we have to do this thing called organizing, and we have to stop servicing the rank and file members of trade unions. And now this is really in the 10 unions who really did get on with the idea that we really needed to organize in organizing, which included Unite at the time, SEIU, HERE before they merged, Meeting and Hotel Workers, AFSCME to some definite degree, United Food and Commercial Workers. There was a series of unions that have held constant who are at least trying to rebuild the base of the labor movement. The question is how. So among those sort of 10 unions that have been trying to do it, I argue that the way the message has been framed is that there were two choices. You could have a servicing union, which is sort of like business unionism, where all you did was service the existing members in a very sort of legalistic strategy about defending individual members' rights on the job. Or you could have this thing called the organizing model. But the problem is, they turned it into organizing only the unorganized workers. So they rejected, the new labor folks rejected doing servicing. So that meant they rejected any real sort of rationale to be having serious conversations with the existing members of unions. And the whole rap was, we have to not spend time talking to the existing members. This is true.
Is that because we got them in the bag? Is that the?
Yeah, we got them in the bag. But as you can tell from the numbers in Wisconsin, the minute that we went right to work, and the minute that we took away the union's ability to collect dues automatically, right? You see how quickly, you see how in the bag they are. We lost 60% of membership in AFSCME in 1 year in Wisconsin after Scott Walker got started, right? So nothing.
Well, almost 40% of union households voted for him in the recall.
38%, yeah. So in the bag. Right? In the bag just meant they were paying dues in 1995. We didn't realize we were going to start having contentious state-level recalls and fights where we would get revealed to us in both Michigan, by the way, right, when the constitutional vote went down on the union household vote, or Scott Walker recall. We had two profound votes back-to-back in Wisconsin and then in 2012 in Michigan when labor got sort of overzealous, just like they did in Wisconsin, didn't do any structure tests, didn't do any assessment of could they win, and put a constitutional amendment to enshrine collective bargaining in the constitution of the state of Michigan, and that went down, and all the analysis also says that went down within the margin of defeat was within union households. But for the moment, we got workers in the bag just meant we got members paying dues in sort of the mid-1990s. So we don't have to worry about them. Because the way the theory about how democratic politics was going to work anyway under people like Andy Stern was we're just going to raise a ton more money from the base, we're going to get a bunch of money, and we're going to cut deals at the top. And we're going to use huge financial resources primarily to try and roll, you know, the kind of Democrats who will support our program, which, of course, it has still not worked. But anyway, I digress. So the focus really begins to shift away from all the existing workplaces. This is among the new labor crowd. Away from the existing rank and file members, away from servicing. But away from servicing, and a lot of progressives knew this early on, was a very dangerous thing to say. So even the framing of servicing existing members versus talking to unorganized workers to rebuild our base, it kind of sounded good, but if you got into the weeds of what it meant, it was actually quite a dangerous message. What I want to argue is, even within that, we did not evolve a real organizing model. We essentially evolved something that I'm saying is a mobilizing model. And to me, the debate we have to have in this country right now is organizing versus mobilizing. Not organizing versus, in the U.S. labor movement, the whole movement we need to debate what's organizing versus mobilizing, whether it's the community organizing sector heavily infused by Saul Alinsky's people, or whether it's the labor movement, or whether it's anyone trying to build power. We have to have a serious discussion about what do we mean by an organizing model. And then what do we mean by a mobilizing model? And then what do we mean, frankly, by an advocacy model? Because all three of those things exist in tension right now inside of unions and also inside of sort of the community organizing, environmental, you know, sort of the non-union sector. I think most people realize that advocacy is just that. It's just a few people speaking on behalf of other people, like what Greenpeace does or Planned Parenthood or something like that, right? It's literally an advocacy group. What's much less understood is what's organizing versus what's mobilizing. And what I draw out in the new article is really an attempt to do that, to delineate those categories very, very carefully. So first of all, in an organizing model, there's several key things that delineate what's organizing versus what's mobilizing. In a mobilizing model, it's a staff-driven model, and that's what evolved under New Labor. A staff-driven, staff-heavy model where staff's job was to go out and sort of mobilize people. And the model shifted a little bit complicated. The model shifted into mobilizing, I argue, because by the late 1990s, the organizing wasn't going so well. Well, that's because the plan was bad, by the way. You couldn't move an organizing plan from the National AFL-CIO, and you couldn't compel the unions to do it, right? So organizing wasn't going that well. Conditions are a little bit rough. Organizing, it turns out, is really hard to do. So people sort of by the late 1990s in the New Voices unions kind of gave up on the idea and instead said, we can no longer win National Labor Relations Board elections. We actually can't win elections anymore. We can't convince workers. We can't help workers understand that forming a union is a good idea because the bosses' fight is too difficult. They fire people. They bring people in. They do all these horrible things, right? So instead of saying, well, what could we be doing differently to help workers understand why forming unions, why building and forming strong unions makes sense, we just said, you know what? Let's forget that. Let's find other let's forget the worker, and let's find other sources of leverage so that we can force employers to come to the table to give us something called an agreement for an election. They're often called EPAs, election procedure agreements in the lingo of the new labor movement. They're often called card check agreements, right? Whereby, so we do a huge thing called a corporate campaign, and that's the evolution of what happened, I think, in the last 15 years.
Which is basically a PR operation.
Well, it's PR. I mean, sometimes it's not just PR. Sometimes it's just what it is. It's a non-worker strategy. It's what I call workerless worker organizing. It focuses on every other aspect of a firm, of a corporation, looking for vulnerabilities and weaknesses that might force them to the table to have a negotiation at the top with union leaders, where we say, we'll take our foot off of your neck and let you breathe again on your tax subsidies or many other bad things, and we should talk about what they are, right? But so what unions began to do is look for ways that didn't have to do with workers. Workers weren't even any part of the discussion. We could go find the vulnerability of a corporation. Sometimes it was bad publicity, but sometimes it was, hey, in this state, the majority of Democrats, the Democratic Party controls the state house. They're better Dems than the national Dems. This hospital corporation or this auto factory or this something is getting huge public subsidies that have to be voted on in the state legislature. We can go stop that subsidy from going forward because we have that much power in about 4 states now. We can stop the subsidy going to that corporation unless they give us a deal that's going to let us easily organize, quote unquote. And that's what I mean. It's not even organizing anymore. But they're going to give us a deal that's going to let us come in and put a bunch of workers into unions without having a big employer fight. Now, that's, again, it's a good theory. It's just that it's morphed into something very dangerous. And is it always dangerous? No, there are still a few unions that actually do those kind of agreements, use those kind of agreements, and still build a rank-and-file trade union. I think the work that we did in Nevada is an example of that, frankly. 3 of the hospitals where we helped workers form really strong unions were off of a blistering fight that got us to an agreement with Catholic Healthcare West that was led by Sal Roselli's team and a bunch of other people in California. So in 3 cases, we were using agreement elections. In other cases, we were having straight-up National Relations Board wars to have an election. So it's not impossible. It's just that the model has evolved into an incredibly top-down model. And you hear some people say, well, what we need, Jane, is top-down and bottom-up. And that's really what we believe in the New Voices movement and the New Labor movement. We believe in a top-down, bottom-up strategy. Well, that's an interesting theory. The problem is the ratio is about 95% top-down and about 5% worker involvement on the bottom. And in the article, I show one of many examples of sort of theories of corporate campaigns and comprehensive campaigns today, which is there's a little map that they draw where they put the employer in the middle, and then they show all the other points of leverage. So you're looking for points of vulnerability in the corporation so that we can step on their points of vulnerability in some way, PR, subsidies, taxes, something, shame them. The latest one out in California that this guy Dave Reagan is pushing, which I think is so insidious and also really dangerous, and it's spreading a little bit right now on the West Coast, is that we go to the community and we say, we're gonna in the states where we can run referendums, we're going to put a referendum on the ballot that's going to be really good for people and really good for consumers and really bad for the corporation, like truth in executive compensation. And then we go to the employer and we show them the polling numbers and say, you know, we can win this, and you're going to have to show your executive compensation in the state of California unless you give us the deal that's going to let us more easily organize the workers. And then if we get the deal, we pull the ballot initiative and screw the community that we work with in a coalition to put the referendum on the ballot. That's a real story I just told you from California. So that's the current evolution of that model, by the way. But so essentially the model, if you boil it down, is a model of union, of quote-unquote, helping workers form unions, but that's the language of 1199 organizer, which is what I was trained as, not the language of New Labor, really. But, you know, we say, if you're really an organizer who wants to help workers facilitate their own class struggle and their own liberation, we see our jobs as actually sort of just teaching, training, and coaching what we call the organic leaders, which is rank-and-file worker leaders in the existing workforce who already have the respect of their coworkers. We see our job as sort of identifying those workers and then coaching and teaching them how to sustain themselves through a really tough employer fight to come. And that's what bottom-up organizing is. That's really what it is. It's a focus on the worker still. And in the local union I was trained in, by the way, 1199 New England, when I was there in the late 1990s, we didn't even have a research. There wasn't even a single researcher. There wasn't even one research. There wasn't even a research department. Like, it was all straight worker leverage. Now there is recognition that 15 years later, things are hard. Things are even harder right now, right? Things are getting worse. So now no one's saying we don't need a little bit of, like, can we find some vulnerability, right, that the boss has? Like, do we know that they have a huge lawsuit where they killed a bunch of patients if it's a hospital? That, hey, we want to trot that out going into negotiations. That's fine. Like, we're not saying don't ever do it. We're saying what do you see as the primary leverage in the model of unionization that you're pushing? Are the workers the primary leverage themselves, or is all this messing around and dancing and playing games at the top level with corporations the strategy that's going to rebuild the labor movement? It's not possible, and that's what we saw in Wisconsin and Michigan playing out.
Speak with Jane McAlevey, the author and organizer. How do the current fast food and Walmart campaigns fit into the new labor, now old new labor organizing model?
They're totally a mobilizing model. That's the epitome of a mobilizing model. It might even be an advocacy model in some cases. But again, mobilizing means, so let me just define it. What I mean by mobilizing, that's what I mean by organizing. By mobilizing, the goal is never to actually get to a majority of the workers. It's actually to only talk to a minority of the workforce. That's what's happening in the fast food struggle right now, right? And it may be for some good reason, which is a longer story, meaning it's a highly transient workforce. It's much harder to build majorities among fast food workers than it is to think about building to majority participation by workers in their own liberation from their employer than it is in a school, for example, where turnover is not yet as bad.
Give it time.
But we don't have that kind of turnover yet in something like a public school or even a nursing home or a hospital. But that goes to my earlier argument about sort of understanding which of these strategies is going to build power, by the way, and which of them is going to teach the class how to fight and win a class struggle. So the fast food stuff is very much a mobilizing model. It's totally staff-driven. It's completely a top-down campaign. It's all about public relations and something called authentic messengers, which is finding the one or two workers per McDonald's who will perfectly paint the liberal image of a single mom with a bunch of kids who gets straight A's and she's, you know, not making it through community college. And I could write the scripts and then they just go find the worker. Like, that's what they do. The sort of PR firm writes the scripts and then they kind of go find the worker that fits into the story that needs to be told to sort of get people to a dollar an hour raise. That really is almost straight advocacy. That's closer to charity and advocacy than it's even a mobilizing model. But now they're doing more mobilizing, right? Now you see some, you know, they call these strikes, which of course I've already explained, I think, once on this show, are not strikes at all, and I resent the use of the term because we shouldn't dumb down a very powerful word. A strike is when a majority of people walk off the job and create a massive crisis for the employer. What's happening in the quote-unquote fast food strikes it's a public relations picket sign, and there's no pretense that any employer is feeling anything except for, we got to get through a bad press day again. That's what the employer's thinking. I got to get through a bad press day again, right? That's not a strike. It's a protest, and we ought not confuse a strike and a protest.
You quote, I think it's your mentor, Jerry Brown, saying that a strike is, it's like a muscle. It'll atrophy if you don't exercise it, right?
Big time.
You need to strike.
Yeah, I mean.
And that's very out of fashion.
It's very out of fashion. And, of course, that's why in the forthcoming book, I mean, which, you know, it's my dissertation now being turned into a book, I took all cases where there had been significant strikes since the year 2000 and analyzed what the model was of the trade unions that were running strikes, including, for example, the Chicago Teachers Union, right? 1199 New England, Chicago Teachers Union, the United Food and Commercial Workers, but only in one particular case, which was a campaign that was down in North Carolina at Smithfield Foods. And so all of the cases of incredible success that I profile in my next book are cases that came from the year 2000 forward, right? So all in the new millennium, at a time when we were the whole message was it's not possible to strike. And I just went and found big strikes where workers won really meaningful changes in their lives since the year 2000 as a direct challenge to New Labor's dogma that we can't, that workers don't want to form unions and they don't want to be militant and they're not willing to be militant and they won't strike. Really? That's actually just not true. It's what choices are being offered by sort of the models of the unions to the workers that they're engaging. That's really the fundamental issue here. So in a bottom-up organizing model, you have to win over the majority of the workforce. There's a fundamental difference. In a mobilizing model, you're talking to a minority of the workforce, not to minorities, by the way, who are not even minorities in the country anymore, a minority of the workforce. You're never going to go out and talk to more than about 10% of the workers in a mobilizing model. That's going to be driving towards a corporate campaign where you're going to have these things that 10% is going to be acting like the authentic messengers in the campaign so that you've got some props with you who can talk to the media. Like, it's like workers as props, I call it, like literally props. Like, oh, you know, go get the tree to put up behind the press conference and get the worker next to the tree. And it's like a worker has become a prop in this mobilizing model. It's really why we see 38% of union households voting for people like Scott Walker, because we've lost any relationship to the rank and file base of unions. In an organizing model, by the way, in a real bottom-up organizing model, the focus is, from day one, is on building to majorities. And as I say in this article, it's not even about just building to majorities. It's an open dialogue from really your first conversation with a worker who's not yet in a union that they're going to have to build to majorities and they're going to have to build the kind of power that can only come from being willing to strike, and they might even have to strike for their first contract. So in a set of unions in this country, a great minority of them, there are still organizers out there, like we used to do in Nevada, and they still do in Connecticut, and they're still doing in a bunch of pockets, and they're still doing in Chicago, where from the opening conversation with a worker who's not yet had a union, the conversation is about building power to make the kind of change that you need to make in your workplace. And the other way that you can build sufficient power to make the kind of changes you want to make in your life for you and your family is if you have the majority of workers standing together and unified to the point where they can actually walk off the job in a strike. That actually still works. We just don't talk about it anymore. So in a real bottom-up model, we literally put the strike word in the conversation from the beginning, and we do that for two reasons. One is to convey what worker power looks like and what they themselves will have to build. And two, because the boss is going to start talking about a strike anyway in an unorganized workplace. The minute that they know the union's there, it's a form of doing what we call inoculation when you're doing bottom-up organizing. You actually have to say all the scary things that the boss will say in the campaign, and we have to say them first to the workers so that they can get their head around what it means. And the boss comes blasting into the, you know, finds out there's a union drive and comes, you know, the union's going to make you strike and you're going to go to union jail and you're going to have union fines and you're going to get locked up. And that's all the stuff the employers in these fancy falutin union busting firms say to people. So there's two reasons. But in the 1199 model or in the old CIO model, I'm linking, and not 1199 New York, I'm not actually talking about New York, for people who may be more familiar with sort of Dennis Rivera's era in New York. I'm talking about the old 1199, the National Union, which still plays out in certain key states in the labor movement. And I analyze, very deeply the model in the paper. So in the 1199 model, which is a bottom-up model, which looks very much like the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the old CIO model from the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s in the heyday of labor organizing. That's what being in the academy has given me time to do, is sort of look back at all the literature from the 1930s. I sort of studied and went back and found organizing pamphlets and little things that you could find that people were using in the CIO in the 30s and 40s and compared them to the model that I was trained in 1199. And you'll see great similarities. It's called bottom-up. It's called class struggle. It's called teaching and enabling the class themselves how to beat an employer fight, how they themselves can build majorities in the workplace, how they themselves can actually build unity of purpose among a majority of people in the workplace, and they themselves can still strike. And since that is still happening at the more local level in a bunch of places in this country, it obviously challenges the rhetoric of the new voices, what evolved to be the new voice mantra, which is that we can only mobilize, we can no longer organize, we can no longer strike, we can only elect Democrats, and we can only do these sort of weird top-down deals. If you push any of them on it and you say, well, how are we ever going to build the kind of power to win labor law reform by electing Democrats since we couldn't do it under Obama, under Clinton, or under Carter, or Kennedy for that matter, frankly, or Johnson, on any of them, from 1947 on, the number one ask of the national labor movement of Democrats since 1947 on has been, to reverse some of what was done to the 1947 Act called Taft-Hartley. We've been asking for and promised labor law reform since 1947. And since no Democrat has ever done it, whether we had plus 60 in the Senate, whether we had supermajority in the House of Representatives, if you push them right now, like, how are we going to do it? Where is it going to come from? There's literally no answer. So my argument is there is only one answer, which is to return to building a bottom-up movement. And it's messy and dirty and really hard, but we actually know how to do it. We've just chosen not to because we think it's easier to, like, wheel and deal with corporate leaders and politicians and not actually invest in the single most important people in the U.S. labor movement, which is workers, both organized and unorganized.
Let's suppose you have a successful organizing struggle, you win recognition, the union is formed. The organizing doesn't stop.
Exactly. In fact, and what you just said, there's a terrific essay. I mean, I hope people get to read this Politics and Society article, but there's a terrific essay, which I think I cite, called Organizing Doesn't Stop by Bob Mollenkamp. And he wrote it in the early 1990s, actually. And Bob was the national organizing director for 1199, the national union, when it was still a national union, before it merged into SEIU. So, you'll see a throughput, right, in the 1199 model. So he wrote a terrific piece called Organizing Never Stops. It's short, it's terrific, and all he does is analyze why one organizer, every time there's an internal action for a strike or a march or a something, tons of members are always there and filling up the buses, and then he compares another organizer who actually doesn't get, who just goes to the sort of more pure servicing model, doesn't keep actually organizing with rank and file, doesn't keep doing mass political education, doesn't keep engaging, you know, doesn't keep having the workers themselves running the union, and those people can't produce anything. That's like a 7 to 10 page article that's as good as, it's just as good as anything else you could read. I think there's a direct link to the piece that I've just put out in Politics and Society and to the longer dissertation. All I'm doing is trying to back up the core belief that organizing never stops. And I'm showing it by showing wild success since the year 2000 out in the U.S. labor movement among the unions who still run strikes. Because the unions that actually are still running majority strikes, real strikes, production shuttering strikes, strikes that hurt the employer very badly on day one, not that they have to respond to in a public relations, you know, can we outdo them in a press release tomorrow? Not that. Not if we just say dollar an hour, can we buy them off? Not that. Like real strikes. The unions that are still capable of running a real strike are the unions that I argue we have to look at, study, very quickly understand, because that's what we have to do in this country right now. We actually have to rebuild our base. It's completely atrophied. So when I quote Jerry Brown saying, the strike is just like a muscle, and if you don't constantly work it out, you actually lose the capacity to just do it. It's a very fundamental concept, which is why I think I also later quote Rob Burrill, who's the organizing director at 1199 New England, same local. Jerry's now gone and retired, but it's the same local. And I quote him talking about what the first conversations with workers are in an organizing campaign that they had recently run and succeeded in, which was from the opening meeting. Hey, you're going to have to get ready to strike for recognition. You're going to have to get ready to strike for your first contract. If you want to make the kind of changes that you want to make, it's up to you to do it. An organizing model is teaching people themselves the art of fighting and winning and building majorities and building solidarity. It's not top-down jujitsu, you know, being played by a bunch of highfalutin staff with big degrees out of the national headquarters that then allows for something called, you know, an agreement to be signed, where workers are just then sort of, you just sort of go in and sign them up. And in the case that I contrast, which is the Washington State case, the SEIU local in Washington State was bought off so cheaply that the agreement was, we go get all the money for the nursing homes, basically in Washington, making it very simplified here, but, you know, the union will go off and get all the money to increase the Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement rates into the nursing homes in Washington State. In exchange for that, the employer will just open the doors and let the union come in and sign up all the workers and get them in the union. But there was a many series of things that went along with that, one of which was surrendering permanently the right to strike in the state of Washington. Like, not just during the contract, past the expiration of the contract, right? So to get these kind of dirty deals, that, you know, we're surrendering the most powerful weapon in exchange for something that actually gets us nothing in the end. And what it gets us is 38% of union households in Wisconsin and 40-something percent in Michigan voting for people who are doing very bad things to workers and their families.
Well, it seems like the boss understands the importance of the strike, but the unions don't.
Yeah, imagine that the boss comes in and says, the most important thing you have to surrender to us is your right to strike. And the union says, sure.
That was your organizer and writer, Jane McAlevey. Her book, Raising Expectations by Raising Hell, was published by Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the 26th of Bach's Goldberg Variations, performed by Andras Schiff. Till next week, bye.